Welcome back to EVR 2858. We're now at Lecture 10, and we're looking at the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe what a manufacturer needs to provide in a statement for registration of a pesticide under FIFRA, the classifications of pesticides under FIFRA, what the difference is between cancellation and suspension under FIFRA, the concept of integrated pest management, the Delaney Clause, what is a new chemical under TSCA, how many risk evaluations must EPA have ongoing every year under the TSCA amendments, what specific substances are legislated to be reviewed by the EPA under TSCA, and examples of and a description of the dispute over genetically modified organisms. So take a look at environmental protection. There's a shifting emphasis. You've got cleanup, control, prevention, but we're trying to shift to prevention, control, and minimal cleanup. Chemicals run throughout our daily lives. There are many different categories that chemicals fall under, and there are a number of differences in where they are used. There are several federal statutes that focus on protecting the health and welfare of the population and the environment as it relates to chemical usage, while still allowing a marketplace for chemicals. There are three laws that cover most chemical usage in our country: the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, known as FIFRA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, known as TSCA, and the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. So let's take a look at FIFRA here. Insecticides, fungicides, and rodenticides have had extensive benefits to humanity. They have done much to spare us from the ravages of disease, crop infestations, noxious animals, and choking weeds that still wreak havoc in the developing world. In the United States, however, Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring showed the general public that these substances were having a harmful effect on the balance of nature as well as to humans. Note, in Lecture 2, you had a reading from Carson's book describing dirt. If you have never read her work, please consider doing so. Her powerful imagery and writing is as remarkable now as it was decades ago. The federal government passed the Insecticide Act of 1910 to protect consumers from ineffective products and deceptive labeling, but did not deal with any type of safety standards. In 1947, with the growth of the agricultural chemical industry, Congress enacted FIFRA, which requires all pesticides distributed in the United States to be registered with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and have some sort of label. Note, in other classes you will learn about safety data sheets, the present-day labeling vehicle for chemicals. Three major problems in the 1947 law arose. One, the registration process was mostly a formality, as the Secretary of Agriculture really could not refuse registration even to a chemical deemed highly dangerous. A chemical could be registered under protest by the Secretary of Agriculture, but this had no legal effect on the ability to manufacture and distribute. Two, there was no control over the use of a pesticide off-label, as long as the actual label complied with statutory requirements. And three, finally, the Secretary of Ag's only real remedy against a hazardous product was a legal action for misbranding or adulteration. Under this scenario, the burden of proof was on him, the Secretary of Agriculture. In 1964, the USDA persuaded Congress to fix two of these three defects. The registration system was revised to permit the Secretary to refuse to register a new product or to cancel an existing registration. Also, the burden of proof for safety and effectiveness was shifted to the registrant. This still left the off-label use of a chemical as a problem that didn't have a federal regulatory mechanism to address. When President Nixon created the EPA in 1970, it inherited the Pesticides Registration Program and all of its problems from the USDA. The EPA summarizes FIFRA as providing for federal regulation of pesticide distribution, sale, and use. All pesticides distributed or sold in the United States must be registered, licensed by EPA. Before EPA may register a pesticide under FIFRA, the applicant must show, among other things, that using the pesticide according to specifications will not generally cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. So what is required for registration? Title 7 USC Section 136 AC1 gives the information for registration of pesticides. Each applicant for registration of a pesticide shall file, no loopholes here, shall, it's a mandatory, with the administrator a statement which includes the name and address of the applicant and any other person whose name will appear on the labeling, the name of the pesticide, a complete copy of the labeling of the pesticide, a statement of all claims to be made for it, and any directions for its use, the complete formula of the pesticide, can't keep anything secret, a request that the pesticide be classified for general use or restricted use or for both, and, except as otherwise provided in paragraph 2D, if requested by the administrator, a full description of the tests made and the results thereof upon which the claims are based, or, alternatively, a citation to data that appear in the public literature or that previously had been submitted to the administrator and that the administrator may consider. Section 5C, approval of registration. The administrator shall, has no wiggle room here, they have to do it, register a pesticide if, and here comes the wiggle, the administrator determines that, when considered with any restrictions imposed under subsection D, its composition is such as to warrant the proposed claims for it, its labeling and other material required to be submitted comply with the requirements of this subchapter, it will perform its intended function without unreasonable adverse effects on the environment, and when used in accordance with widespread and commonly recognized practice, it will not generally cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. Now, what does unreasonable adverse effects on the environment mean? This is the operative phrase in the registration criteria, unreasonable adverse effects on the environment, which was added to the Act in 1972. This phrase is defined in FIFRA as meaning any unreasonable risk to man or the environment, taking into account the economic, social, and environmental costs and benefits of the use of any pesticide, or a human dietary risk from residues that result from a use of a pesticide in or on any food inconsistent with the standard under Section 346A of Title 21. The administrator shall consider the risks and benefits of public health pesticides separate from the risks and benefits of other pesticides. In weighing any regulatory action concerning a public health pesticide under this chapter, the administrator shall weigh any risks of the pesticide against the health risks, such as the diseases transmitted by the vector to be controlled by the pesticide. So about pesticide uses. The registration of a chemical specifically identifies the crops and insects on which it may be applied. Each use must be supported by research data on safety and efficacy. Registrations are for a 5-year period, after which they automatically expire unless an interested party petitions for renewal and, if requested by EPA, provides additional data indicating the safety of the product. Note, it is important to note that having a chemical registered does not mean it can be used for any purpose. EPA also has the responsibility to classify pesticides when approving the registration. So Section 136A, subsection D, tells us the classification of pesticides. Pesticides can be classified for general use, restricted use, or both. It is up to the EPA administrator to classify a pesticide. The company that produces the pesticide can request a specific classification, but the administrator has the final say. Pesticide uses may be classified by regulation on the initial classification, and registered pesticides may be classified prior to re-registration. If some of the uses of the pesticide are classified for general use and others are classified for restricted use, the directions relating to its general usage shall be clearly separated and distinguished from those directions relating to its restricted uses. General, restricted, all right, what does this mean? General use means that you can buy the product at your local grocery. The product's label spells out how it is to be used, and so long as Susie Public follows the directions, there should be no unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. Curious how this looks? Take a look at a can of Lysol disinfectant spray ingredients. Restricted use means that the product is too hazardous for general use and is limited to only certified applicators. FIFRA has a system of examination and certification both at the private level and at the commercial level for applicators who wish to purchase and use restricted pesticides. The distribution of restricted pesticides is well monitored. The FIFRA process. The registration process is the core of FIFRA. The cancellation component is also highly important, attracting the most attention. Cancellation is the vehicle used to force a review of a substance that is suspected of posing a substantial question of safety to humans and/or the environment. During the cancellation proceedings, the product may be freely manufactured and shipped in commerce. However, initiating a formal process of cancellation usually leads to a public hearing and/or scientific review committee, taking years to resolve. So Section 136DB, cancellation and change of classification. If a pesticide or the material submitted for registration doesn't comply with the law, or when used in accordance with widespread and commonly recognized practices, the pesticide causes adverse environmental effects, the administrator can publish a notice that the administrator intends either to cancel the pesticide's registration or change its classification, along with the administrator's reasoning and supporting facts or data, or to hold a hearing on the pesticide's possible cancellation or change in classification. The administrator must consider the following factors before canceling a registration, changing a classification, or issuing a notice of such action: the production of agricultural commodities, the prices of agricultural commodities, retail food prices, and other factors impacting the agricultural economy. The action becomes final after 30 days unless the registrant can correct the problem or a person impacted by the action requests a hearing. Then there's suspension. A suspension order is an immediate ban on the production and distribution of a pesticide. It is mandated when a product constitutes an imminent hazard to humans or the environment. This may be invoked at any stage of the cancellation proceedings, or even before a cancellation procedure has been initiated. The purpose of an ordinary suspension is to prevent an imminent hazard during the time required for cancellation or change in classification proceedings. The registrant may request an expedited hearing within 5 days of receipt of the administrator's notice. Note, see above for the general description of cancellation as a comparison to the description of suspension here. Suspension is in Section 136DC. If there appears to be an imminent hazard, the administrator may, doesn't have to, but can, suspend the registration of a pesticide immediately, even if cancellation or change in classification proceedings have been started. If cancellation or change in classification proceedings have not been filed against a pesticide, the administrator must file such proceedings or notice simultaneously with the order of suspension. The administrator must notify the registrant before giving notice of suspension and include in that notice the findings and data specifically used to show there is an imminent hazard. The registrant may request an expedited hearing on the suspension. So, what's imminent hazard? It should be noted that the phrase imminent hazard does not mean or permanently impart the concept of a pending crisis. Operationally, it means that the greater the amount of credible evidence the EPA has about potential dangers posed by a registered pesticide, the more quickly and easily its use can be discontinued, and more pronounced benefits must be in order to justify its continued use. Emergency suspension. The emergency suspension is the strongest action EPA can take under FIFRA. This action immediately halts all uses, sales, and distribution of the pesticide. An emergency suspension differs from an ordinary suspension in that the registrant is not given notice or the opportunity for an expedited hearing prior to the suspension order taking effect. The administrator can only use this procedure when he determines that an emergency exists, which does not allow him to hold a hearing before suspending use of a pesticide. Section 136DC3, emergency order. If the administrator finds that not only does an imminent hazard exist, but it is an emergency situation where immediate action must be taken and there is no time to wait for a hearing, the administrator may issue a suspension order before notifying the registrant. Such emergency suspension order may be issued before a notice of cancellation or change in classification. The administrator has 90 days, so 3 months, from issuing an emergency order to give notice of cancellation or change in classification. Otherwise, the emergency order shall expire. So, prevention. FIFRA operates in a preventative manner in that it functions as an upfront regulatory mechanism, i.e. before a potentially dangerous pesticide is introduced into commerce. That being said, the standards used are not solely driven by a safety criteria, as the economic benefits and costs of regulation are weighed at the registration, cancellation, and suspension stages. So FIFRA's licensing scheme, there are drawbacks to the licensing system. One, there is no oversight during the development stage, and thus it is hard to determine a chemical's long-term effects if they were not part of the research and development phase. Without indications of chronic toxicity, it is hard to justify lengthy, expensive bioassays. And two, FIFRA only deals with new or prospective risks. In other words, the chemicals that have been in use for some time are likely to be less well tested, representing an information data gap. This has been somewhat resolved in FIFRA's 5-year registration period, after which reconsideration is necessary. So, integrated pest management. Ultimately, the best way to prevent pesticide pollution is probably through the concept of integrated pest management. This philosophy focuses on a combination of biological and management controls along with targeted applications of pesticides, ideally only when absolutely necessary and where least likely to cause environmental damage. A recent FIFRA ruling in December 2022, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that an earlier decision to allow the use of bee-killing insecticide sulfoxaflor for long-term use did not adequately examine ESA issues and remanded the case back to the EPA. A summary of the decision can be found here at E&E News. Well, what about Florida pesticide law? And yeah, this is one of my favorite cartoons about Florida and love bug season. What about Florida? Are pesticides controlled solely by federal law? Of course not. Florida has established the Florida Pesticide Law at Florida Statute Section 487.011 and is administered by the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. The state laws tend to cover both the actual application and usage. There are requirements for proper branding of products, as well as penalties for misbranding. There is also a registration requirement. So Florida Registration, Section 487.041 requires that every pesticide which is distributed, sold, or offered for sale within this state, or delivered for transportation or transported in interstate commerce, or between points within this state through any point outside this state, shall be registered in the office of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Each registration shall be renewed annually. The registration statement shall include the name and street address of the registrant, the name of the pesticide, an ingredient statement, a complete copy of the pesticide's labeling, a statement of all claims to be made for it, including directions for use, and a guaranteed analysis showing the names and percentages by weight of each active ingredient, the total percentage of inert ingredients, and the names and percentages by weight of each added ingredient. So back to the money trail. Remember, when we've looked at Florida law in the past, there is always the money element. Well, the pesticide law is no different. Florida pesticide law registration fee. For the purpose of defraying expenses of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, in connection with carrying out the provisions of this part, each person shall pay a biennial 2-year registration fee for each registered pesticide. Here is where it gets interesting. 487.0411C says, for each registration in odd-numbered years, so this year because we're in 2023, the registration fee is $700 per brand of pesticide and a fee of $200 for each special local need label and experimental use permit. For even-number years, i.e. last year, the registration fee is $350 per brand of pesticide and a fee of $100 for each special local need label and experimental use permit. All registrations expire on December 31st of the second year of registration. So take a look at this. If you want to be cheap and you want to not have to pay a lot of money, well, then you're going to register in the even years, even if you have to wait a year. Florida can restrict the pesticides it allows to be used within state borders. Enforcement and inspection. Florida also reserves the right to inspect pesticide storage and sample the pesticides there. 487.0711. Florida law gives the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services the authority to enter upon any public or private premises or carrier where pesticides are known or thought to be distributed, sold, offered for sale, held, stored, or applied during regular business hours in the performance of its duty relating to pesticides and records pertaining to pesticides. So if we're talking Walmart, because Walmart distributes, sells, offers for sale, holds, stores, and, well, sometimes applies on their property different FIFR-related fungicides, insecticides, and rodenticides. And it says regular business hours. Well, if Walmart's open 24/7, I guess you can, you know, stretch that. If it's a insecticide company that only works a 9-to-5, well, then the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services are stuck visiting 9-to-5. Sampling and analysis. Florida Statute 487.0712. The department is authorized and directed to sample, test, inspect, and make analyses of pesticides sold, offered for sale, distributed, and used within this state at a time and place and to such an extent as it may deem necessary to determine whether the pesticides or persons exercising control over the pesticides are in compliance with Florida law. Now to switch gears a little. We have the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. Why in the world am I talking about food, drugs, and cosmetics? We don't deal with the FDA or anything like that. Well, there's some interesting thoughts in here. Congressman James Delaney, Democrat, New York, sponsored legislation to amend the Federal Food, Drugs, and Cosmetics Act. The amendment was enacted in 1958 and stated, "No additive shall be deemed to be safe if it is found to induce cancer when ingested by man or laboratory animals, or if it is found after tests which are appropriate for the evaluation of the safety of food additives to induce cancer in man or animals." 21 U.S.C. Section 348 C3A. Now, in 1996, Congress amended the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act to exempt pesticide chemical residues from the Delaney Clause. For such residues, the Delaney distinction between carcinogen and non-carcinogen was replaced with a new distinction between threshold and non-threshold toxicants. This required EPA to establish a tolerance for a residue in or on a food if it is determined that the tolerance is safe and that there is a reasonable certainty that no harm will result from aggregate exposure to the pesticide chemical residue, including all anticipated dietary exposures and all other exposures for which there is reliable information. For non-threshold toxicants, a tolerance must meet two sets of conditions: one concerning the health risk posed by the residue, and a second concerning the economic benefits from use of the pesticide chemical that produces the residue. So it used to be nothing could be put into our food system that could induce cancer. Now it can. Looking back in our class, if you remember back to the introduction and NEPA lecture, the U.S. Constitution does not give us the right to a clean environment. And until these environmental laws were put in place, people and corporations essentially had the right to pollute in any way they wanted to. As you can tell by this 1996 amendment, we no longer have the right to a chemical-free food marketplace. Granted, we have a lot more scientific data and study results than we did when Delaney was in Congress, but it is still a little disconcerting in some ways that our federal government, of the people, by the people, and for the people, are the ones who okayed poisoning the people. So now let's look at the Toxic Substances Control Act. The Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976 extended the market access concept to most new and existing chemicals. Both environmental and industry groups lobbied heavily during congressional deliberations over TSCA. The result was perhaps the most complex, confusing, and ineffective of all federal environmental protection statutes. Now, that seems very ominous that TSCA is ineffective, but after 40 years, Congress updated this law through the Frank R. Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act, Public Law 114-182. It was signed into law June 22, 2016. The new law, which received bipartisan support in both the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate, includes much-needed improvements such as mandatory requirement for EPA to evaluate existing chemicals with clear and enforceable deadlines, new risk-based standard, increased public transparency for chemical information, and consistent source of funding for EPA to carry out the responsibilities under the new law. Here is a clear graphic on the major differences between the original TSCA and the new law. So, existing chemical review. The old TSCA said there was no duty to review, no deadlines for action. Now, EPA has a mandatory duty to evaluate existing chemicals with clear and enforceable deadlines. There is an assessment standard. The old TSCA was against risk balancing standard. Well, now chemicals assessed against a risk-based safety standard. New chemicals review and SNRs. Chemicals can enter the market in the absence of EPA action, but now this requires EPA to make an affirmative determination on new chemicals and existing substances subject to SNRs before entry into the marketplace. SNRs stands for Significant New Use Rules. Then there's the TSCA inventory. The old TSCA said substances on TSCA inventory are not set as active or inactive. The new TSCA requirement says requires industry to report on the chemicals they manufactured or processed in previous 10 years to determine if chemicals are currently active in the marketplace. Chemicals on TSCA inventory will be set as active or inactive. This graphic was posted by the Chem Safety Pro website in its review of the TSCA update. For a reasonable review of the complete TSCA update, The Atlantic published an article by James Hamblin that reviews the update, noting that it doesn't cover everything. The article starts out describing how asbestos affects the human body. It also points out that while asbestos is illegal in more than 50 countries, the United States is not among them. The Environmental Protection Agency attempted to make asbestos-containing products illegal in 1989 and succeeded temporarily. But the ruling was overturned in 1991 after appeals by manufacturers. The weak point for the regulatory agency was the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976, the law that ostensibly regulates household and industrial compounds, chemicals in the stuff under the sink or in the garage, which, when put to the test, did not afford the EPA enough power to ban asbestos. This update has put EPA more in the driver's seat. The EPA has set out how it is implementing the new law. Now note, I said that this was passed in 2016. Well, there were about 4 years where nothing was truly done on it. So it's gotten more attention now. So new chemicals. Under TSCA, the EPA administrator had no say over how companies created new chemicals. The administrator didn't see anything until an applicant applied for a registration under FIFRA or TSCA. That has changed. Now, chemical companies must submit pre-manufacture notices. The EPA must review and make an affirmative determination on all pre-manufacturer notices, PMNs, microbial commercial activity notice, MCANs, and significant new use notices, SNUNs, before manufacturing can commence. So, what is a new chemical? EPA says, if a chemical is on the TSCA inventory, the substance is considered an existing chemical substance in the U.S. commerce. Any chemical that is not on the inventory is considered a new chemical substance. The EPA has a webpage dedicated to the TSCA chemical substance inventory and explains which general categories of chemical compounds are on the TSCA list and which are covered by other federal laws, like insecticides falling under FIFRA. Initial risk evaluations. The TSCA amendments required the EPA to update the 2014 TSCA work plan and run chemical risk evaluations on chemicals listed under TSCA. Congress set out in the TSCA amendments that TSCA requires that for each risk evaluation completed on a high priority substance, EPA must begin a new risk evaluation. By the end of calendar year 2019, EPA must have at least 20 chemical risk evaluations ongoing at any given time on high priority substances. The law requires that at least half of all EPA-initiated risk evaluations be drawn from the 2014 update to the TSCA work plan until that list has been exhausted. So, the EPA had to create a new process for evaluating the safety of existing chemicals called prioritizing. That requires EPA to separate chemicals into high priority and low priority lists. The first 10 chemicals selected for risk evaluation off the high priority list were asbestos, 1-bromopropane, carbon tetrachloride, 1,4-dioxane, cyclic aliphatic bromide cluster, methylene chloride and methyl pyrrolidone, perchloroethylene, pigment violet 29, and trichloroethylene. If you're curious about these chemicals, the EPA has posted the scope and supplemental documents. Industry can also request the EPA to run risk evaluations on their chemicals. Any risk evaluations requested by industry are separate and distinct from Congress's newly imposed required risk evaluations. Fees rule. A huge addition to TSCA is that the EPA must now impose fees on certain chemical manufacturers, including importers, to provide a sustainable source of funding to defray costs of implementation of the new responsibilities under the amended law. This gives the EPA the money for running the new risk evaluations to determine exactly how much risk these chemicals truly pose to human health and well-being, as well as the environment. Inventory rule. Congress has included an inventory requirement to require industry reporting of chemicals manufactured, imported, or processed in the U.S. over the past 10 years. This reporting will be used to identify which chemical substances on the TSCA inventory are active in U.S. commerce and will help inform the chemicals EPA prioritizes for risk evaluation. Specific substances. The original TSCA set out specific rules on asbestos, indoor radon, and lead exposure. The amendments added mercury to this list. TSCA inventory updates. The inventory of TSCA chemicals was last updated in February 2022. The link to the updated database is there. All right, so let's take a look at genetically modified organisms. How about bioengineered products such as GMOs? GMOs are a really touchy subject. Back when GMOs were first being envisioned and biologists were just beginning to tinker with gene modification, GMOs were viewed as a possible panacea to reduce use of pesticides since they are, quote unquote, natural substances. EPA has primary responsibility for bioengineered products. Biopesticides are covered under FIFRA and other biotech products as new chemicals under TSCA. The Food and Drug Administration deals with GM food products for food safety under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. The USDA regulates the release of genetically modified plants, animals, and microorganisms. GMOs are covered by federal laws, and these organisms could provide us with so many advantages over traditional chemicals. Now, what is a GMO? Genetically modified organisms can be defined as organisms, i.e. plants, animals, microorganisms, in which the genetic material, DNA, has been altered in a way that does not occur naturally by mating and/or natural recombination. The technology is often called modern biotechnology or gene technology. sometimes also recombinant DNA technology or genetic engineering. It allows selected individual genes to be transferred from one organism to another, also between non-related species. Foods produced from or using GM organisms are often referred to as GM foods. The term generally does not cover organisms whose genetic makeup have been altered by conventional crossbreeding or by mutagenesis breeding, as these methods predate the discovery of the recombinant DNA technique. Think monk Gregor Mendel and his experiment with peas. Examples of GMOs are diverse and include transgenic experimental animals such as mice, several fish species, transgenic plants, or various microscopic organisms altered for the purposes of genetic research or for the production of pharmaceuticals. The term genetically modified organism does not necessarily imply, but does include, transgenic substitution of genes from another species. Glowfish. The glowfish is a trademarked brand of genetically modified fluorescent zebrafish with bright red, green, and orange fluorescent color. Although not originally developed for the ornamental fish trade, it is the first genetically modified animal to become publicly available as a pet. The glowfish was introduced to the United States market in December 2003 by Yorktown Technologies of Austin, Texas, after more than 2 years of extensive environmental research and consultation with various federal and state agencies, as well as leading experts in the field of risk assessment. The definitive environmental risk assessment was made by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which has jurisdiction over all genetically modified animals, including fluorescent zebrafish, since they consider the inserted gene to be a drug. Their official statement made on December 9, 2003 was as follows. Because tropical aquarium fish are not used for food purposes, they pose no threat to the food supply. There is no evidence that these genetically engineered zebra danio fish pose any more threat to the environment than their unmodified counterparts, which have long been widely sold in the United States. In the absence of a clear risk to the public health, the FDA finds no reason to regulate these particular fish. Similar findings were reached by the State of California Department of Fish and Game and State of Florida Transgenic Aquatic Task Force. So frankenfruit and frankenveggies, what's the big deal? Some see the science itself as intolerable meddling with the natural order, despite known examples of natural genetic crossings occurring throughout history. Ecologists see possible chaos in introducing GMOs because they are non-native organisms. And as we know, in Florida, non-native species can take over areas and crowd out native species. Other controversies include the definition of patent and property pertaining to products of genetic engineering and the possibility of unforeseen global side effects as a result of modified organisms proliferating. Aren't GMOs just like crossbreeding? The good old Gregor Mendel crossbreeding experiments with peas that every high schooler knows about? You take two varieties of a plant and cross-pollinate the varieties and try to combine the best features of both varieties. What is so different about GMOs? Well, specific genes are inserted into the DNA structure. Monsanto and Monarchs. Let's take a look at this. Monsanto developed a GMO hybrid corn that they planted and started to develop, which didn't need mass amounts of pesticides. Everything looks good, and the crops are having good yields. No one is getting sick. What's the problem? Monarch butterflies. Monarch butterflies feed on the pollen from the corn, and the pollen doesn't agree with the butterfly system, and they die. So monarchs are losing their native habitat due to expanding growth, and now they are losing their lives due to GM corn. BT corn and monarch butterflies. So in May 1999, a laboratory at Cornell University published the results from a laboratory trial that appeared to indicate that the pollen of genetically modified BT corn presented a threat to monarch caterpillars. Critics claim that the popular media was wrong to report that monarch butterflies were threatened because this experiment did not duplicate natural conditions under which monarch caterpillars may come in contact with corn pollen. So what happened to the butterflies? In 2001, the scientific journal, The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, published 6 comprehensive studies that showed that BT corn pollen does not pose a risk to monarch populations for the following reasons. The density of BT corn pollen that overlay milkweed leaves in the environment rarely comes close to the levels needed to harm monarch butterflies. Both laboratory and field studies confirm this. There is a limited overlap between the period that BT corn sheds pollen and when caterpillars are present. Only a portion of the monarch caterpillar population feeds on milkweeds in and near cornfields. Another article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, published in February 2019, reviewed the recent decline of monarchs using museum specimen records to chart monarch and milkweed occurrence over the past century, so 1900 to 2016, dating well before previous data sets begin in 1993. We show that monarch and milkweed declines begin around 1950 and continue until the present day. So the BT corn really isn't responsible for the decline in monarchs. It's us mowing over things and getting rid of milkweed. Starlink. Does anyone remember the Starlink corn brouhaha? Well, Starlink corn was produced by inserting the gene for CRY9C into certain corn hybrids. The gene that makes the CRY9C protein, an insecticidal protein, was isolated from a common soil bacteria, a strain of Bacillus thuringiensis. So CRY9C containing corn hybrids provided corn growers BT-based insect protection and control of European corn borer and southwestern corn borer. In addition, suppression of black cutworm was possible with these corn hybrids. Unresolved questions surrounding the allergic potential of CRY9C protein in humans led the EPA to determine that further data was needed before food use could be approved. In September of 2000, CRY9C gene fragments were detected in taco shells. A boycott of Taco Bell taco shells ensued. In October 2000, Aventis Crop Science voluntarily withdrew the registration for Starlink corn. So Starlink corn is no longer available for sale. Seed companies destroyed their stocks of Starlink corn seed. The use of Starlink corn in livestock feed and industrial non-food uses still has EPA approval. So what's the current status of GMO foods? Well, they're banned in European Union countries. They're banned in Japan. They're banned in Mexico. For the total list of countries in 2023, I direct you to countries that ban GMOs. Still being experimented within the US and other countries, though many crop-producing counties in California have laws on the books banning production of GMO foods in those counties. There is a lot unknown about the possible negative effects of GMOs, and the companies manufacturing them are out there seriously promoting their GMOs as the ultimate panacea to solving a variety of crop growing problems. An ecologist's nightmare come true. Next class, we will look at the Solid Waste Disposal Act, the Resource Recovery Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. See you on the discussion boards.